It's good to be with you. I hope you're at least as awake as I am. I'm still a bit jet-lagged, so, you know, if I sort of nod off in the middle of a lecture, you'll know what happened to me. What I want to do this morning is, you know, there are a lot of trends in New Testament studies that I could talk to you about that have arisen over the last 20, 25 years, and even some in the last 5 or 6 years. But since most of you are in pastoral work or are teaching at a theological college or even in lay ministry of some form, what I'm going to concentrate on is those methodologies and trends that I think have more cash value for pastoral ministry and are more helpful to those who are interpreters and preachers and teachers of the Word going forward. So, I mean, there are a lot of things we could talk about, but I'm going to talk about only the ones that I think are most useful. What I'm going to talk about in the sort of first half of our time this morning is the socio side of things, of socio-rhetorical criticism. I mean, some of you know that I've written a whole series of commentaries on the New Testament, most of them from a point of view of socio-rhetorical analysis of the New Testament, which I think is a very, very fruitful way to understand and analyze the New Testament. So we're going to deal with that for most of the morning, and then towards the end of the morning, I'm going to talk a bit more about New Testament rhetoric, the ancient art of preaching. So what I want to do first is talk to you about the sort of schools of thought from which these methodologies have arisen and then applied to the New Testament. What we've got over here is sort of a list of these different realms of thought that have been then applied to the New Testament, analysis of the New Testament fruitfully, one of which is cultural anthropology. Some of you may know the work of Bruce Molina in his book, The New Testament World. He's the one, more than any other, who has applied insights from cultural anthropology to the study of the New Testament. And then there's a whole group of scholars called the Context Group, which some of whom are here in Australia, some of whom are in South Africa, some of which are in North America, applying these kind of methodologies to the analysis of the New Testament. We're going to talk a little bit about that first. And then there are things that come from sociology and the social sciences, and I'm going to talk to you about some of those methodologies and how they help us analyze the New Testament. And then I'm going to talk about something that's really a forte of the scholars at Macquarie. My good friend Ed Judge and Bruce Winter, who teaches here, who was a student of Ed Judge, and other of the scholars, Alana Nobbs, and from Macquarie, we're going to talk about social history and how that helps us understand the context of the New Testament. And then last, we'll talk about Greco-Roman rhetoric and how that's used in the New Testament. So these are the particular things I want to focus on and find helpful. Now, it has been said that the past is like a foreign country. They do things differently there. Now, if you've ever traveled to a foreign country, you will realize that one of the first things that strikes you about it is it's, wait for it, foreign. That is, the things that you find habits of the mind or heart or behavior are not the same. I mean, obviously, when I get off the plane in Australia and see people driving on the wrong side of the road, this is foreign to me. You know, and so one of the things you need to understand about the Bible is that culturally it was a very different world in many ways from the one we live in. The characters in the Bible were not late Western chaps with late Western cultural values indebted to a Eurocentric worldview. This is not who they were. And if you sort of read the Bible with those kinds of values and views, you know, you're as likely to read into the text things that are not there as to read out of the text what the Bible's actually saying. So one of the things that we have to do when we interpret the Bible is guard against anachronism. That is, reading back into ancient documents things that are entirely modern concerns, ideas, and thoughts. Okay, and we, unfortunately, it's almost unavoidable. We all come from a cultural point of view. We all come from a certain school of education. So we're bound to do that. We're all modern people, or even postmodern people. And we're bound to do that. So one of the hedges against misinterpreting the Bible is actually understanding first-century family values, actually understanding first-century cultural values, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about in a broad sense, first of all. The first of these concepts that I want to really stress to you is the concept of honor and shame. Now, when I'm lecturing to my South Korean students or my Philippine students or my students from Hong Kong or Singapore, they get this far more quickly than students from North America or England or Scotland or places like that. The world in which Jesus and Paul and James and Peter and Aquila and Priscilla lived was absolutely an honor and shame world. When you think about a hierarchy of values, at the top of the hierarchy of values, at least in North America, is not truth versus lies or honor versus shame, but at the top of the hierarchy of values in America is life and death. I mean, we even have cliches like, well, that's not so terribly important. It's not a matter of life and death. Now, my own observation, which is an amateur one of Australia when I've been here on various occasions, is Australia in that regard is not much different from North America. The highest value in the ethical hierarchy of values in this culture is not truth versus lies. If it was, we wouldn't have some of the politicians that we have. And it's not honor versus shame either. No, the highest value really, practically, day-to-day speaking, in the culture is life is the highest possible value. And at all costs, you want to avoid death. So you have a trillion-dollar industry investing in pharmaceutical products, hospitals, and the mantra of all of that is, at all costs, prop up life. Well, ancient peoples didn't have the same kind of values that we do. Most ancient peoples, the top of the value hierarchy was honor and shame. The goal of life was to obtain honor, not just for yourself, indeed not even primarily for yourself, but for your family and for your kin group, and for your ethnic group, whether you're a Jew or a Roman or a Greek or some other kind of person, a Parthian, a Mede, whoever you might be, and avoid shame, avoid public scandal. Now, these concepts are indeed dyadic concepts. Honor and shame are the antipodes of this spectrum of way of looking at life. Let me give you an illustration from World War II. When young teenage Japanese boys in kamikaze planes not only bombed Pearl Harbor, but in some cases crashed their planes into American aircraft carriers and other things, I mean, Americans had a hard time understanding this. Why would young people with everything to live for do such a thing? I mean, they're young and they're healthy. Well, the answer is because more important than life and death to them was honor and avoiding shame. That was the most important thing in the whole world to them, to honor the motherland and support the values of their culture. And at the very top of that cultural hierarchy of value was honor and avoiding public shame. Sometimes in the Orient today, it's called having face, giving face, losing face, those sorts of things. This is what I'm talking about. It's honor and shame. Well, the world in which Jesus and Paul lived in was far more like a modern Oriental culture than it is like a modern Western culture. And let me just say to you that when a culture loses its sense of shame, it also loses its sense of honor. When it loses its sense of sin, it also loses its sense of sanctification and what is actually holy. These concepts go together. So one of the really fruitful ways of analyzing the New Testament is in terms of honor and shame. And, you know, these terms come up in the New Testament over and over and over and over again. Now, sometimes when we analyze that in the New Testament, one of the things that becomes clear to us about this is that honor is a public value and shame is more of a internal private matter. It was the job in a patriarchal culture for the men to establish the honor of the family in the public sphere. They were the representatives of the family to the world in the community, and it was their job to establish the honor of the family in its name in public. It was the chief job of the mother and the wife to avoid shame. Specifically, of course, most particularly sexual shame. The woman was the protector of the inner core values of the family. The man was the representative of the family, establishing the public honor and reputation of the family externally to the community. And that's the way it worked. And what this led to, among other things, of course, is a sexual double standard. So which group was held to a higher standard of sexual rectitude? Clearly the women were. Clearly the women were, because for a woman to shame the family was to strike at the very core of the family values of a Greek culture or a Roman culture or an Israelite culture. This is part of the way the patriarchal world worked. Well, that's very different from the way the Western world works today in many regards. We basically are not an honor and shame culture. Now, I grew up in the Old South in the United States. And when I was a small child in the 50s, if the mayor of my town had a scandalous divorce, he would have to resign. Why? Because at that point in our Southern culture, we were still very much an honor and shame kind of culture. Today, there's no shame in that. In fact, we almost expect it of our celebrities and politicians, you know. And in some places like France, they even celebrate it, you know. Well, what's happened is that whatever vestiges there were of honor and shame in the Western culture has pretty much been processed out of the culture at this point. So sin is reduced to just a mistake or an error of judgment. It's not an offense against God. It's not something shameful. It's just bad judgment, you see. Well, that's not the way an honor and shame culture is. In the Bible, you will find passage after passage after passage that really uplifts this issue of honor or this strong sense of shame. In fact, in Hebrew, I mean, you have terms which literally mean things like to lift the face. When God recognizes you, or Jesus says, well done, good and faithful servant, in the Hebrew, the actual verb that was is used there is to lift the face, to give someone face. To accept face is to honor another person. And, that's language that comes right out of the honor and shame discussion. Now, the second of these values, and you need to understand all of these are interrelated values, all right? The second one that is a strong disconnect with Western culture today is dyadic personality. We are, as Westerners, products of the Enlightenment, a very individualistic culture. Have you ever noticed that people in the New Testament don't have last names? I'm trusting you know that Christ was not Jesus' last name. Are you with me now? People don't have last names. The cell phone log and the telephone directory must have been terribly confusing. They didn't have any last names. Last names are what distinguish our identity as Western persons. Me from you. You from you. You from you. Individual identity is not the primary identity of ancient persons. Group identity is. The primary identity is the collective identity. So when Paul brags about his biography, how does he start out? I am a Hebrew of Hebrews, an Israelite amongst Israelites, a Pharisee amongst Pharisees. You know, he doesn't say, I'm a person whose last name is Tarsus. You see, ancient people didn't have last names. So how do you distinguish one ancient person from another? Well, you often would distinguish them geographically. Saul is Saul of Tarsus. Jesus is Jesus of Nazareth. I'm trusting you know Magdalene is not Mary's last name. She's Mary of Migdol, tiny little seaside village on the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee. People were distinguished by their point of geographical origin, or sometimes they would have a patronymic. Patronymic is saying whose son they were. So Simon is Simon bar Jonah. Bar-Jonah means son of John or son of Jonah. Jesus, however, of course, called him Cephas, so his real name was Rocky Johnson. Honestly, he didn't have a last name. He was the son of John or the son of Jonah. Still, another way to distinguish ancient people was if you had multiple members of a family or a group, and say you had two Jacobs. And by the way, all of the Jameses in the New Testament are not Jameses. They are Jacobs. They are Jacobs. And all the Marys in the New Testament are not Marys. They are Miriams, named after the Old Testament prophetess. And they had biblical names. They didn't have late Western names like James and Mary. Those are Anglicizations of these names. Well, how did you distinguish one from another? Well, you'd have James the Less and James the Greater. I mean, you still have this in Italy when people have gigantic families. This is little Luigi, big Luigi, fat Luigi, et cetera, you know, and they're all brothers or cousins or whatever. In fact, in antiquity, you would often have a family where you had two children with exactly the same name. So you'd have little James and you'd have big James. Okay? This is not because they lacked imagination. This is because individual identity was not that important. The group identity is what mattered. Now, the theory of dyadic personality is the theory that you get your primary identity from the family unit, the kinship group, the ethnic group that you are a part of. That's your primary identity. And the way you find out who you are is not by establishing my individual identity and being independent from my parents. Nothing like that. The way you find out who you are is by asking other people in the know who you are. So Jesus takes his disciples to Caesarea Philippi and says, "Who do people say that I am?" This is not because he's having an identity crisis. This is the normal way to talk about your identity. What does the group say about me? Group identity, primary. Individual identity, entirely secondary. Have you noticed that all of the Christological titles applied to Jesus, almost without exception, are relational terms? He is son in relationship to man. He's son in relationship to God. He's the Lord over somebody, but you can't be a kurios unless you've got servants or slaves. Christos is the anointed one of God. These are all relational terms. They don't tell us who he is as an individual. They tell us who he is in relationship to God or human beings or Israel or whoever else. These are relational terms. The primary identity is relational. Individual identity is entirely secondary in such a culture. Absolutely so. Now, this is a major disconnect with late Western individualistic culture. This is something that you have to literally harp on to get people to even to begin to grasp this in the church in Western society. Much easier for me to talk this way to some of my African students from Bulawayo or Pretoria. They understand that the kin group is primary and that their individual identity is entirely secondary. They get it right away. True in Oriental culture too, but Westerners not so much. I am Ben Witherington III. I come from a long line of Witheringtons, you know, and it kind of goes like that. I got news for you. That's not a biblical way of looking at persons. It's not the way the Bible talks about human persons. Dyadic personality is a theory that helps you understand collectivist or group identity and how identity is formed. Now, most ancients believed, stick with me now, that the three G's are what determines your identity. And it's determined from birth. Geography, gender, and generation. The three things that determined your group identity is A, where you're from, B, what sex you are, and C, who's your daddy. Not who's your mama, who's your daddy. These are patriarchal cultures. Okay, I mean, look at the genealogy in Matthew 1, the very first chapter of the New Testament. All right? It's got begat, 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 but it's a really weird, squirrely genealogy that even the Mormons can't quite figure out. For one thing, it skips various generations. For another thing, all of a sudden, Mary is shoehorned into Joseph's genealogy so you can get Jesus in there because of the virginal conception. This is a very odd patriarchal genealogy, to say the least. So, generation, gender, geography determined your identity. So, for example, in the early chapters of John, you know, Jesus shows up, and one of his erstwhile potential disciples says, "Come and meet Jesus of Nazareth. He could be the Messiah." And the immediate words out of this man's mouth as a response is, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" See, what they believed is that geographical point of origin ruled out the idea that Jesus could be a Messiah. Because your identity is determined by geography and gender and generation. Those three G's determined your identity. And here's something else you may have a hard time grasping. Most ancient people did not believe in conversion. They had sayings like, "Can a leopard change its spots?" We have sayings like that too. "You can't teach old dogs new." Yeah, you know what I think? I think most of the Australian world doesn't believe in conversion. It believes in therapy. That's a whole different ballgame. You can ameliorate the bad effects of your personality with therapy, but there is no real healing. There is no radical change. There is not any truth. Most modern psychology doesn't believe in radical transformation of a personality. Most secular psychology doesn't believe in that at all. We're a little weird because we believe in conversion. Even early Jews mostly didn't believe in conversion. You remember the conversation that I like to call Nick at Night, Jesus and Nicodemus? Remember this conversation? What does Jesus say to a godly, pious teacher of Israel named Nicodemus? He says, "You need to be born again," or another way to translate that would be, "You need to be born from above." And Nicodemus's instant reaction is, "What? I can't crawl back into my mother's womb and call for womb service. What are you talking about? Of course I can't do that. What do you mean born again?" On the other hand, I have a colleague who grew up in the Nazarene tradition in Indiana, And they were always going to revival meetings and always going to the altar and rededicating their life to the Lord. And he once humorously said one day, "You know, I've been born again so many times, I have stretch marks on my soul." Ancient people didn't largely believe that you could dramatically change who you are. Early Christians did believe this. Jesus believed this. Jesus believed in conversion, not just a change of denomination, but conversion. And Paul certainly believed it. If anyone is in Christ, they are what? A whole new creation. Behold, the old is past. Most ancient people didn't believe that at all. You know, we have this problem as well. There's a profound cynicism when somebody claims, "I've been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. I've been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb." You know, and they're going, "Yeah, right. Well, show me. Prove it to me. Let me watch the pattern of your behavior for a while, and then maybe we can talk about that." Even in the church, there's a pretty profound cynicism about some of that. The values that Jesus and the earliest Christians taught were in many ways countercultural values. They didn't go with the flow of the culture. They went against the flow of the culture. For example, Jesus was all the time violating the honor codes. He goes and eats with sinners and revenue men, tax collectors. This was, as the British would say, not done. An honorable person, a person who cared about honor, didn't do that kind of thing. Jesus traveled around Galilee with a bunch of women. This is totally countercultural. You don't run around anywhere with women you're not related to. This is scandalous. This is shameful. So one of the things we need to understand is that Jesus did not come to conform to the expectations of his culture. And neither should we. He didn't come to meet our expectations. He came to meet our needs. And that's a horse of a different color. Honor and shame, dyadic personality. Now, this third one is often a disconnect as well. I mean, at least in North America, there's a lot of people in denial about a whole host of things like global warming, okay? They're in denial that we're eventually going to run out of fossil fuels. They're in denial about all of that because they don't believe in the concept of limited good. They don't believe in the concept of limited resources. I mean, we have commercials on American TV for particular food items. The byline of the commercial is, "Eat all you want, we'll make more." When I go and give a talk to elementary school kids in America, one of the things I like to talk to them about is food and where food comes from, to make them think. You know what the number one answer of children is about where food comes from? The grocery store. It's not from the farm, it's from the grocery store, right? Magically appears in plastic packages in the grocery store, right? You know? That is actually a recent cultural change in the West. In the year 1900 in America, 66% of all Americans lived on a farm. In the year 2000 in America, 6% of all Americans lived on a farm. This is an enormous change in one century. No wonder all the elementary schools say, "I know where food comes from, the grocery store." Not so much. The truth of the matter about the world we live in, friends, is it is a world of limited goods and limited good. Some cultures got the memo about that and some didn't. When I teach in Moscow, my Muscovites have no problems relating to this because many of them remember standing in bread lines for 2 hours and then getting to the front of the queue and there's no more bread left. They know what it means that you can run out, that there isn't any more. Well, this culture that Jesus and Paul lived in was not a free market economy culture. It was not a capitalistic economy culture. It was largely a barter culture. And one of the most fundamental assumptions of this culture was, if you've got it, I probably don't. And if I want it, what do I have to do? I have to bargain with you to get it, or I have to steal it, put the five-finger discount on it. Because there's only limited goods, not everybody can have them. Now, one of the reasons for that is the stratified nature of ancient society. 2% of the population of the Roman Empire controlled 98% of the Roman Empire's wealth and resources. There was hardly anything like what we would call the middle class in Western society in the world of Jesus and Paul. It's a very different economic situation. When Jesus is asked, should we pay the tribute money to Caesar, Jesus doesn't even have a single coin on him. He has to ask for a coin. Whose picture's on it, says Jesus? Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God. Do you understand the irony of that? From Jesus' point of view, it all belongs to God. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Caesar's not the owner of any of it. So there's irony in this little aphorism, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God. He's not talking about a separation of church and state. He's asking them to have a revaluation of their values and rethink what really belongs to whom. Now, in that culture, money was minted by rulers, okay? Money was minted by rulers, and the coins quite literally belonged to the person who did the minting. That's who they belonged to, okay? So Jesus' response is a perfectly natural one in that culture. But the whole way they viewed goods and money and resources was very different from us. I've written a book recently called Jesus and Money, because we're going through an economic malaise and mess in America, and Christians tend to be as much debtors as everybody else. And one of the things that it seems to me, there's such a profound disconnect amongst modern Christians on this subject, is they don't understand that the Bible says that none of us are owners of any of this stuff. The Bible does not advocate private property or public property. It advocates God's property. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. We are only stewards of it. And even if you're buried with your pink Cadillac, you can't take it with you, and you didn't bring it with you when you came into this world. You're just a steward of God's property. You know, if the church really got hold of that concept, it would revolutionize all kinds of things, including giving to the church. The tithe is not only merely a minimum of what ought to be given. It needs to be understood that that doesn't mean that the 90% now belongs to you and you can do with it what you like. It all belongs to God. And God may require of you sacrificial giving, which goes way beyond the tithe. I don't really think the way we think about matters, practical, monetary, and economic, is very biblical at all. We have simply absorbed the larger values of our culture, baptized them, and called them good. God bless our standard of living. If you really sort of think through biblical values, even the economic teaching of the Bible is so radical that it makes even the most conservative of Christians blink. You remember one day when Jesus was sitting across from the temple treasury, and here comes a widow with, she has only two coins as liquidatable assets, right? And this widow puts in all of her living, as it's called in the King James, all the liquidatable assets she has in the temple treasury, but there's all these wealthy people that put far more quantitatively in there. And Jesus says, which one's given the most? He's calling his disciple to sacrificial giving, not to tithing, to sacrificial giving. Really sacrificial giving. Now, I'm trusting you know the difference between a gift and a sacrifice. You know the old story about the farmer who had chickens and hogs, and the chicken and the hog is having a conference early in the morning, and the chicken says, oh my gosh, the farmer wants breakfast again. I've got to go lay another egg. I've got to make a sacrifice. And the pig snorts and says, sacrifice? He wants bacon too. You're just making an offering. There's a difference between an offering and a sacrifice. The Bible's values reflect these values, but critique them in a countercultural way. The next concept that you need to understand is that the way things worked in the ancient world is patrons and clients. Patrons and clients. You wanted to get ahead in life? You didn't just go to Queensland Theological College and apply for a job. No, it was not what you knew, it was who you knew that got you ahead in life in antiquity. Most people were not wealthy. Only a tiny minority of people were wealthy. And the way that you got ahead was the ancient Near Eastern practice of sucking up. You went to somebody with your hat in your hand and said, let me be your client. Will you be my patron? And what happens is when you get in a patron and client relationship, you get in the reciprocity spin cycle. Many of you will probably have a long time ago seen the movie The Godfather. And what you may not know is that mafia culture is Mediterranean culture. It's in miniature, a form of Mediterranean culture, and it's based on all of this sort of stuff right here. So when Don Corleone says, I want you to do me a favor, after which I will do you a favor, then you will do me another favor, then I will do you a favor, then you will do me a favor, or you will sleep with the fish. That's the reciprocity spin cycle. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. This is not a world that talks about grace. It talks about payback. Now, here's my question for you. Is the Australian culture more run on the principle of reciprocity and payback, or on the principle of grace and forgiveness? You think about that for a minute. I can say for America, it's really clear. Americans don't much believe in grace. They believe in payback. There's a lot of problems with that, not the least of which is that the Bible says, vengeance is mine. I will repay. It has been said that if we offered salvation for 25 quid a head, you'd have a line from Brisbane to Cairns ready to buy it. But because we offer it for free, people are suspicious of it in our culture because we live by the aphorism, you don't get something for nothing. There's always a cost. What do I have to pay to get it? See, that whole reciprocity mentality comes out of the ancient practice of patrons and clients. And once you became somebody's client, you were likely to be their client for a very long time. And it was only the patron who decided when you could terminate the relationship. You couldn't go walkabout. You couldn't just quit. The patron had to decide the nature of the relationship, the principles of remuneration, how much you would get paid for doing this, that, and the other, and so on. Now, what did the patron get out of all that clientage? Well, sometimes he got manual labor, but more often than not, the main thing a patron wanted from the client was the publication of the honor of the patron. So what you find all over the biblical world is patron columns. Publius Maximus was the greatest patron of all in this city, and in his honor, his friends, which is a euphemism for his clients, his friends have erected this column in his honor. It's patronage and clientage. That's what it is. It's not friendship. But the patron did call his clients his friends. Well, they were not in a parity relationship. It was a superordinate, subordinate kind of relationship. That's the way the ancient world worked. You know what? Jesus didn't work that way. Jesus talked about the least, the last, and the lost becoming the first, the most, and the found, and getting in the kingdom ahead of those who were the privileged. He really was doing a number on cultural values and critiquing them in a countercultural way. The last of these sort of dominant building blocks of ancient culture, let me just finish this bit and we'll take some questions. The last of these building blocks that was an absolute taken for granted part of Greek culture, Roman culture, Israelite culture, Egyptian culture, Parthian culture, Median culture, you name it, is patriarchal orientation. It was a man's world. So much was it a man's world that you not only had arranged marriages, marriages were arranged between two men, the father of the groom and the father of the bride. You know, there was not all this romance and Romeo and Juliet and this sort of stuff. Yeah, even marriage was a property transaction between two families. And when we talk about families, dear friends, we're talking about extended families. We're not just talking about the so-called nuclear family, parents and children. We're talking about parents and children and Aunt Susie and Uncle Bert and cousins and slaves, if you were fortunate enough to have any. We're talking about a different model of family than we have today as well. Family values in the first century looked rather different than they do today. I mean, read the household codes in Paul's letters. He's always on about not just the husband and wife or the parents and the children. He's also always on about the slave owners and the slaves. That was the nuclear family in that world, and it was a top-down patriarchal structure. There was one person at the head of the pyramid of the family. It was the person who played three different roles and wore three different hats. The husband, who was also the father, who was the slave owner. One person, three different roles. Everybody else in the family played different roles. Only one person played the three top dog roles. That would be the father, unless, of course, he died, and then there were some families that were run by the mother by default after the fact. That did happen. It's a patriarchal culture. So much is it a patriarchal culture that, so far as I can find historically, no Jewish teacher, rabbi, prophet, priest, or anybody else had female disciples before Jesus did. I mean, I can see the Galilean Gazette now. Radical rabbi on the road again with women and men he's not related to. Oy! News at 11. Jesus was all about reconstructing family values. And he was not all about just reaffirming the status quo of the patriarchal structure of society. In many ways, he was deconstructing that. Now, these six things that I've listed are just some of the major building blocks of ancient culture. And what you need to know about the New Testament is that an awful lot of what's going on in the New Testament is not simply a baptizing of these values and calling them good. A lot of what's going on in the New Testament is a critiquing of these values and a reorienting them. But that does not mean that they were all simply rejected. They were certainly critiqued and reoriented, and some of them were rejected. But this is the structure of first century cultural values. All right, let's take some questions before we take a break. Don? You know, that's a really good question. One of the mistakes we make as Westerners is assuming that first century slavery was exactly like, for example, antebellum slavery in America before the Civil War, or slavery in the British Empire before people like Oglethorpe and others came along to revamp such things. I think the truth of the matter is that, if you look at actual relationships, in Roman law, a slave could buy themselves out of slavery, and there were an awful lot of people who deliberately sold themselves into slavery because it was an economically more secure situation. So it's very different, for example, than American pre-war, Civil War slavery, where there were laws prohibiting the manumission of slaves or the emancipation of slaves. In Roman law, there were all these processes by which you could get manumitted. You know, somebody on your behalf would go to a priest and pay some money, and slaves were able to make money, so they could actually buy their way as long as their master was prepared to let them go, and then they became freed men and freed women. There are real problems with ancient slavery. No doubt it's a sinful institution, very clearly. But it's also a different economic institution than the one that comes from later Western culture. And it doesn't stand on all fours with that. The way that I would read slavery in antiquity is that domestic slaves tended to have a much better lot in life than agricultural slaves. The truth about agricultural slaves is, the ones that built the pyramids, the one that dug all the mines, all of that, they had a very short life expectancy, and their labor was, their life was cheap, and expendable, and it was horrific. What's interesting to me is how Paul works to put the leaven of the lump into the Christian community to change things. He's not on about protesting to the Roman emperor, we need to get rid of slavery. No, what he tries to do is put the leaven of the gospel into the community so that it will voluntarily reform. So he says things like, in Christ there is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free. And if you read Philemon closely, it's very clear from Philemon that he's telling Onesimus, there's this incompatibility between Onesimus being your brother and Onesimus being your slave, and you really need to let him go. Well, I think the seeds of the emancipation movement come right out of the New Testament. But there are levels of discourse. Paul was a smart pastor. He began with people where they were, and then he tried to move them in a more Christian direction over time through building relationships. That's what's going on. So one of the things that irritates me as a New Testament scholar is the sort of glib, well, the Bible supported slavery, therefore the Bible is an antiquated book and not worth its ethical pinch of salt, and so we can just dismiss whatever the Bible says about this. Well, my response to that is you actually do not understand what the Bible says about slavery in its original context, because what's going on is a process of change is being set up. And the basis of that change, above all other things, is that each person is created in the image of God and of sacred worth, and we're working against anything that denies or denigrates that, working for change over time. Yes, sir. It's fairly close, except this. Roman law, even at its most liberal, did not accept the principle that slaves were persons. Okay? No, slaves were what was called living property. So there was an actual principle in law that said, for example, that slaves couldn't become members of Senate, and slaves could not become this or that or the other. They were simply movable property. Living property. I just came 2 weeks ago from having a little holiday with my family in St. Louis, and there's a courthouse right in downtown St. Louis where the Dred Scott case was tried before the Civil War, well before the Civil War, in 1834, as a matter of fact. And Dred Scott was a slave who had slaves. in the state of Missouri. Only there were people in Missouri who didn't think that was right. And so he went to court not only to be allowed to emancipate his own slaves, but to no longer be a slave. And this is a court case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And at the end of the day, the U.S. Supreme Court confirmed the judgment that he was a piece of property rather than a person. But this was one of the straws that broke the camel's back and instigated the American Civil War. No, Roman slavery, however generous and gracious the noblesse oblige could be between an owner and a slave, they were still property. And at the end of the day, the owner could always hold that over their head. They could not free themselves without the permission of the owner. And, you know, and here's the other interesting thing. I mean, so unthinkable was it in the first century AD that slavery could ever be done away with, that even the slave revolts, I mean, some of you may have seen the movie Spartacus or read about that sort of thing. I mean, the point of the slave revolt was, well, let's do away with slavery. That's not the point of the slave revolt. The point of the slave revolt was we think the conditions of slavery are abominable and need improvement. The point was not to do away with slavery, because even the slaves didn't think that slavery would ever come to an end. That's a radical idea, and that really wasn't an idea that much existed in the first century world. Yes, sir.
You made a comment about the notion of grace
that society at the time. Not biblical society. I mean, it's certainly there in the Old Testament, and certainly there in early Judaism, no question about that. But in the larger culture, it's pretty much not part of the culture. Mm-hmm. Oh, excellent question. Several things about that that's different. A patron and a client have some kind of personal relationship, but they don't have the kind of intimacy that amounts to a family relationship between a father and a daughter or a father and a son. I mean, it's not accidental that Jesus and his successors use the language of mother and father and brother and sister spiritually. The nature of the relationship we have with God is Abba. This is the most intimate of all possible kinds of relationships. So God is far more than our patron. He's our parent. He's our spiritual parent. And so, yeah, it's far more, and in any case, patron and client is an employment language. It would be trivializing the relationship between God and his people to call it mainly a patron-client kind of thing. I mean, there's an element of that, of course, because God is always superior, and we are always his servants. We don't ever cease to be the servants of God. But the language is used in a transmogrified way. It's not used in the same way it would be used in a larger culture.